The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What's your definition of the New West?
Such a good question. I have sort of two parts to it. The first part is that what's new about the West actually involves problems that are old, challenges that are old, that the West still hasn't overcome and never will. It's still an arid place. It's still a place where class matters, where there's a separation between the rich and poor. It's still a place where geography is dominant. It's still a place that has a really intricate relationship with human migration, partly because of the aridity and the scale. And it's a place that still hasn't come to terms with the realities of the indigenous peoples who remain. So some of those things are still there. What I think I also see happening and am interested in happening is, will digital technology, will high tech change some of these challenges or not? And I think that, for instance, the class question is an interesting one. If the West becomes a place where people can move and telecommute and overcome some of the obstacles that have kept most of our towns and cities pretty small, that could exacerbate the class situation in some ways, where the West just continues to be a playground for privilege. Or it could change things. It could mean that lots of different kinds of people, a more diverse population, a more interesting population, or just population of the size that keeps some of our smaller towns and cities constantly on the edge of social cohesion, that might actually be a plus. So I feel like the 21st century technology is an issue. We see other kinds of technology. What is fracking going to really mean for resource use in the whole North American continent, not just the American West? In the years I've been here, we've gone from coal being king to potentially natural gas, which can be found lots and lots of places, being dominant. So that resource economy that is the one that at least rules the roost in Wyoming may change, and may change very quickly in a profound way. I'm interested in that. And any of the demographic things, the West is just going to become more ethnically diverse, like all of America is. It already was ethnically diverse, and it was from those first few waves of settlement, but it's just going to continue to be that. And it's going to be an intersection between Chicano culture, white culture, Native culture, in complicated ways for a long time.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Allison Hagee about her novel Boleto, which is the story of a Wyoming cowboy. Well, the Testerman Ranch is, I'm not sure where it is on the social scale. We can talk about that a little more. But Will Testerman is part of a Wyoming ranching family. He's got two older brothers, mother, father, all of whom work non-ranch jobs in order to keep the ranch. Why don't they just sell the land, move into town, be in the place where they work?
Because they really see themselves as people having land, having economic independence, working with large animal, cattle, and horses, even though that's not the reality. The dream is really powerful. And for his father, who has always hoped to get enough money together to buy more deeded land, to have enough land to be able to operate a cattle enterprise, he has failed to do that, and he sees himself on the edge of failure for a long time, and he's bitter about it. That said, he still passed that dream down to his sons. I think it's a dream that's very alive in lots of places in America. I think it comes from our immigrant background, maybe, where in America you could have land. And so even though you can't get enough of it or not enough of it to survive on, it still becomes this very romanticized, desired thing. It's pretty typical in Wyoming. I won't speak for the rest of the West, but for these smaller ranches around these towns to be family enterprises where everybody has another job, or almost everybody has another job. And you will almost always find one of those people having a job, maybe even a public entity job with health insurance.
Will's mother is a school teacher, and she asks him every day, "Who are you today, Will Testerman?" Which I think maybe is to his detriment, because his brothers and his father kind of look on him as a dreamer. They don't take him very seriously.
They don't. He's different from his brothers. You know, Chad, I think of as the most practical of the brothers, and he's gone to college and gotten an engineering degree, and he's figured out a way to live in the West. He's going to make enough money to ski and have a kind of house he likes, and to be a hobby rancher if he wants. But Will's gift, he's really good with horses and cattle in a way that his brothers aren't. And the question is, can he figure out how to make his gifts, can he figure out a way to put a real sustainable life together? I think for people who work with horses, that's an abiding question, often for decades, because they inevitably, in order to work with really fine animals, you end up working with someone with a lot of money, and you have to go where they send you. That's just a sort of reality. But Will is not the practical cat that his dad is, or Chad, and Everett really wants to be a rancher. He's just probably not savvy enough for it, frankly. I don't know if you want to say that Will is spoiled. I don't think that's true. I think that he simply has a set of gifts that don't work so well in our supply and demand kind of economy, or at least the one you would find outside a small town in Wyoming.
Let's get to know these people a little bit by hearing you read the first few pages from the book.
She was a gift, though he did not think of her that way for a very long time. He paid $1,200 for her, money that came straight from his single account at Cabin Valley Bank. She was halter broke and trailer broke, and she'd been wormed for the spring. Someone had taken a rasp to her feet. He had seen her dam, Sally's Quick Ticket, win more than one prize in cutting horse competitions. He had no knowledge of her sire. The man who bred her kept good horses at his ranch outside of Cody on the South Fork of the Shoshone River. The man did not use his horses much, but he had an experienced manager, someone who knew how to care for foals and weanlings. When the man chose to sell some of his animals, the manager, a careful fellow by the name of Campion, asked around. Campion did not go in for the commotion of stock sales. He had four horses he needed to sell, and the prettiest one was a quarter horse filly that was barely 2 years old. She was nicely balanced. There was a decent chance she had inherited her mother's speed. Was it true what he had heard? Campion asked on the telephone. Was he still in the market? He knew $1,200 was a bargain for a strong-legged filly with papers. He knew that even before he saw her. His name was William Testerman, and he was 23 years old. There were days he felt older, and days he felt as lost as a blind pup. His parents had raised him in a way that allowed him to take account of the weaknesses he might find within himself. His older brothers, Everett and Chad, had managed to cover the bases on the family ranch. It was a small place, just 90 deeded acres, set along one side of Little Kettle Creek. The town of Lost Cabin, Wyoming, had grown up to the edge of the ranch, and the town was growing still. It was his father's joke to refer to the hay meadows and corrals he owned as the Lost Cabin Municipal Golf Course. "Town is eating its way right past us," his father said. "When I was a kid, you couldn't pay people to live in this part of the state. Too cold, too much isolation. Now everybody in America thinks they're in love with fresh air and loneliness." Will knew the Testerman Ranch was not going to become a golf course, but it would remain forever small, even if the grazing permits in the Rampart Range west of town were renewed at a reasonable price. There was some work for him on the place. His father had an ongoing contract with the feedlot in Powell, but he could not see himself in those fields or along those well-strung fence lines, not in the years ahead. His mother was a schoolteacher in town. He believed he owed some of his restlessness to her. She had taken on full-time work when he was old enough to go to school, and the two of them had driven to and from Lost Cabin for many years. It was a short drive, but in those minutes together, often in the blue cold of a winter morning. They would talk about their days, about who they were. His mother had traveled some when she was young. She was also a great reader of books. She would say to him, "Who are you today, Will Testerman?" And he would say, if he wished to disappoint her, "Today, I hate arithmetic." More often, he would say a thing to entertain her or to warm up the teacher in her. He would say, "Today, I'm a Minuteman from Massachusetts," or, "Today, I'm the man from over there in France who discovered germs." It wasn't hard to please his mother or to make her laugh. This was true even after a difficult day, one that left a grayish color around her lips. She only wanted to talk to him. She only wanted him to know how big the world was. He had lived away from home for a while. He had wrangled horses on the Black Bell Ranch nearly every summer since he turned 16. They liked him at the Black Bell, which was an old-style guest ranch in the Absaroka Mountains east of Yellowstone. They said he could have a job there whenever he wanted. After high school, he spent a few months driving vans for a California firm that shipped horses up and down the West Coast. The job had been a serious change of pace, but he had quickly found its limits. He'd spent two semesters taking classes at the community college in Casper. It was a chore that pleased his mother more than it pleased him. The best stint was in Texas. That lasted almost a year. He had worked for a big money outfit in Texas, and there had been a great deal to learn about people and about himself and what he had best stay away from. His brothers liked to pretend he hadn't done anything of value in Texas. They told friends Will had tied colored ribbons into the manes of horses that sold for the price of a Denver Broncos tight end. They said he babysat rich girls. The friends wanted to hear more about the girls, so he shared the kind of stories that made him out to be the fool. He knew his place around his brothers. They were welcome to laugh at him. He had gone to Texas, which neither Chad nor Everett had done, and he had watched men and women down there do their jobs the way they liked to do them, and he had learned. He was not stubborn in the way of his brothers. He didn't mind starting at the bottom of a thing and climbing up. He acquired the filly sooner than he planned. He thought he knew why that had happened. He had the money, first of all. He had been careful that winter. He took every small job that was offered except those that might have kept him away from home at night. This meant he did not go into the Garnet Field, where the natural gas outfits were drilling wells faster than a rabbit had babies. Chad, who had gone to college to be a geologist, was in the Garnet Field. Chad made good money. He lived with a girl in a nice apartment in town. Everett was still very much at home, and he managed the comings and goings of the family cattle when he was done with his shifts driving truck for Cabin Valley Beverage. Will had not wanted to keep those kinds of hours. Their mother had been sick. There had been 6 weeks of chemotherapy in Riverton and six more of radiation after that. The doctors hoped the cancer was gone. They had caught it early. Will had made it his business to stay close to his mother, to drive her where she needed to be driven, and to sit in the house while she lay down in her bedroom. He tended to her. It wasn't a problem. But seeing his mother on her feet again, hearing her joke about her hair and how it was growing back in funny gray curls, opened a gate for him. There was also the business with his neighbor, Annie Atwood. Annie had disappeared the previous summer while she was running near Flat Top Mountain. There was no good explanation for what had happened to her. Will had been questioned by the police more than once because he was Annie's friend. He had plowed her driveway during the winter with the ranch's plow, and he had known her all of his life. Annie's disappearance had torn up a lot of people in town. It had raised hard questions, and people had said things in their distress that were difficult to take back. He didn't think it was wrong for him to plan on leaving Lost Cabin for a while, at least until the air around town tasted less sour in his mouth. He told Campion he would drive up to the ranch on the South Fork of the Shoshone on Monday. "You bring in a trailer?" "You think I should?" "I guess I do, or I wouldn't have mentioned it." "She got the build?" "I guess I think so, or I wouldn't have called. I know every man has his own way of seeing a horse, but I'd bet money I know how you'll see this one." He went to the bank that afternoon. When he took the cashier's check from the teller, his hands felt steady and warm.
You You've been listening to Allison Hagee read from her novel Boleto. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. If you tuned in late, you can listen to what you missed from our blog. Look for it at mtpr.org/twq. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about the compromises some cowboys make when they work on dude ranches and hear about the young man who inspired this novel. Don't go away. What does Will want from this horse?
I think the filly for him represents independence, but a new kind of independence. He wants to prove to himself that he can take a really special, a really beautiful animal and treat her so well and so professionally that she can be successful as a polo pony, which is a field that he is not an expert in. So I think he wants to prove that he can nurture her literally up until it's time for her to be saddled and broken to a profession. But also he wants to prove to himself that it doesn't matter what kind of horse it is, that he can create a champion. He's done roping. He's done some reining. He's been around some saddlebred horses. But this will be a new and different challenge. And he's very eager to prove to himself that his expertise can be translated across class and across culture.
For most of the book, this filly doesn't have a name. And without giving away too much of the plot, because she doesn't get a name until near the end of the book, can you just say why that is?
Well, first of all, I think it's pretty typical for what I'll call performance horses that they don't get names for their first or second year. I don't know if it's a superstition that goes back to maybe they won't make it, they'll die or something, but that's pretty typical in my experience where foals and weanlings will be called by their mother's name or some variation of their mother's name or by their color. But I also think for Will, it's part of the commerce. If he names her, she becomes part of his sphere in an emotional way that he's not ready to cope with because he plans all along to sell her, or he thinks he plans all along to sell her, and he thinks he's going to be able to do it on his own terms. So he's kind of holding his own emotional investment at bay, I think. I also think that sometimes we wait for animals to sort of reveal a kind of character, which is one of the reasons that in some of our religious traditions we give young people confirmation names when they're 12 or 13 to add to their birth names, knowing that their true essence isn't going to reveal itself until they've matured, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I was also thinking that if he gave her a name, then she's more like a pet instead of a business transaction.
I think that's really true. Yeah. And Will is one of those horsemen who thinks he's making a really clear distinction between pet and commerce. He has Hawk, the Appaloosa, who he's decided he'll keep until Hawk is with us no more. Hawk's a working horse, but he's also a little bit more in the pet category. But this filly from the get-go is supposed to represent really a chance for him to earn big money and to show that he can make a living away from his family, not just a subsistence-level living, but what his brothers would call real money.
Mm-hmm. During the novel, Will works in several places where he's employed by wealthy people. Do you think his misunderstanding of them, of their social rules, is what gets him in trouble?
I think it does get him in trouble sometimes. I think sometimes those people move their rules around, too. I mean, when he's in Texas, he's doing everything professionally. But when those teenage girls start really sort of, I guess, yanking his chain, he gets in big trouble in a way that he can't predict, and I don't fault him for that. I think he very much misreads what's going on in California on the Polo Estancia. Some of that's cultural. Some of it's also his wishful thinking. He just thinks people should treat people well all the time and they should treat their horses well all the time, and he's just not fully prepared for the length to which some people will go to get what they want.
Mm-hmm. One of Will's habits is to, quote, read the country for signs of posterity and struggle as he passed through it. Why is that habit of observation useful to someone like Will?
Well, I think it's a habit that I borrowed from my own father growing up in a rural place where people tend to live far apart from one another. So you look for the smallest signs of change since you're not actually likely to see them physically. And I think in the American West, you become so good at reading the sky, so good at reading the landscapes. You have so much memory about how each meadow and field has been used, how each river and creek flows, that when you see a sign of change, it registers pretty powerfully. And those are a big deal. A for sale sign means it's not talk anymore. It means someone is pulling up stakes. And animals crowded in the wrong pasture at the wrong time means something. Either someone's made a mistake or there's been a death in the family, but the family has changed its rhythms, and that change may be related to economic problems. And I think Will is very, very good at sussing out the strains and challenges that his neighbors and family suffer from.
Your writing would probably be best described as lean. I mean, it's many other things too, but I'm sure people have said to you that your writing is lean. For instance, Will looks at the filly and he thinks, quote, the sight of her midnight silhouette made his hands ache. There's so much emotion and information in that short sentence. Did someone teach you to write like that? Did you just learn it from reading, or does it just come out of your head that way?
I think it's a real change. I think my writing is much more lean and much more austere since I've been in the American West. It's really true. I come from a pretty loquacious Scotch-Irish background. My early stories are very influenced by Eudora Welty, William Faulkner, Catherine Ann Porter, also Flannery O'Connor, though, who is a pretty lean writer, actually. I've been rereading her recently, and she's no muss, no fuss. She says what she means pretty directly. So for me, it's been an evolution, and I think it has everything to do with the landscape out here, the quality of the air and weather, and the way people measure their words. And I think some of that has just been absorbed over the 17 years I've been out here.
Since he was 16 years old, Will has spent summers working at a guest ranch, and it's just mind-bending to me to think about this. Will is a rancher, cowboy, horse trainer who can't make a living on his own ranch. So he's being paid by some wealthy people to pretend he's part of the Romantic West, which doesn't even exist. So it seems to me like he's more of an actor than he is a cowboy.
I think you're right. We have good friends who manage an old guest ranch in northwest Wyoming. And there's an element of performance to it. There just really is. I mean, the guests expect everyone to dress a certain way. There's a fair amount of joshing and joking that goes on in the staff kitchen about putting on the appropriate costume to greet the guests and all that kind of stuff. I also just feel like it's a reality. If you want to work with horses and you want to have an outdoor summer doing work you love in a place you love, you're going to have to fit into whatever the economic reality is. And for quite a few young people, guest ranch work is pretty lucrative. or lucrative enough to make it worthwhile. And so Will is both a real cowboy and a pretend cowboy at the same time. And I'm really interested in that tension because I'm also interested in why people want to come to a place and see that kind of performance.
Do you remember the cowboy that inspired this book?
I do, vividly. So I was fishing on a small river in northwest Wyoming, and it was dusk, and I was coming off the river. And I could see someone was working a horse in the round pen, but everything else was silent, and that was unusual. There was something really quiet, really balletic about what was going on. And I got close enough to see that it was a horse I didn't recognize. There are about 65, 70 animals on this guest ranch at any given point, and this was not one of them. And I could see that it was the assistant head wrangler. I hadn't met him yet. I'd heard he was a very good horseman, and I just paused and watched him just work her. He wasn't saying anything. The night hawks were flying. The bats were flying. It was really, what do I want to say? It was like a piece of silent theater. Almost. And that's all I did. I don't think he ever saw me. I didn't stay long enough to disturb anything. I slipped off and went to where I needed to be. The next day, this same young man was giving a demonstration to guests on some horsemanship, and he brought out this filly. And I knew it was the same one as soon as I saw her because she was smaller, and she was an extraordinary color and just beautiful, beautiful. And you could see by the way he stood next to her that there was an investment there that was not like the investment he had with the other horses he'd brought or the other horses in the corrals. So he did his demonstration. Some people asked some questions. And afterwards, I just said to him, "Where did you find her?" And he said, "I've been looking for her for a very long time." Now, he was only 21 or 22, so how long could he have been looking? But in his mind, it had been years. And without prompting, as I recall, he said, I'm going to train her really slowly, and it's my goal to take her to California and see if I can sell her for a polo pony because I've heard you can make a lot of money that way, and it's something none of my friends would ever do." And that was the extent of the conversation. I just sort of filed it away without any notes or anything, and then 7 years later, the idea for the book just came barreling into my head from nowhere. I've never tried to find out what happened to that young man. He had his own life and his own filly. I hope it went really well for them. But I felt like I needed to imagine my way through that story. And I found trying to be in his skin, trying to think about what it would be like to be somebody who's gifted with horses, trying to make a 21st century living, really interesting. The book felt fun in a lot of ways, ways that previous novels haven't, which is interesting to me, and I felt was a real gift.
Allison Hagee lives in Laramie, where she teaches creative writing at the University of Wyoming. You'll find more information about her and the book at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, links to our podcast and Facebook page. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.